We've been on this course now for at least three previous conversations and a lifetime of experiences, because each one of us brings to the table something that has not yet been discussed, which I'm sure we won't have time to discuss today either. But to presume that the content of the conversation called Dynamic Judaism can be found on a sheet of paper is to forget that the word dynamic requires living participants. So nothing that I say today, at least my intention, is not to replace human living experience with codes. Because that doesn't work. Only when it's alive, only when it's experienced, does it matter. In the same sense, at least this is my theology, what good would the idea of God be if there weren't people thinking about it? Then the God, at least that I believe, which is all alone, and therefore the reason for our being, would remain all alone, and we'd have no reason for being either. And that would defeat the purpose. So the conversation of dynamic Judaism requires that we talk about it together. The outline has been so far. Part one was an introduction to dynamic Judaism, primarily based on the book of Zvarim, the book of Deuteronomy, in which we're told, do not add or subtract from this tradition that I give you today. It's a biblical command not to add to tradition. In the same book, the Torah, and in the same book of the Torah, Zvarim, we're also told, whenever you have a question that you haven't yet answered, that's too baffling for you to describe, to explain, turn to the judges in your day. Which is strange, because if you're not supposed to add or subtract from the tradition, what answer might the judges come up with who are bound themselves by the very same injunction not to add or subtract? So the question of dynamic Judaism, though it was not called Judaism then, it was called the Israelite religion, if anything, though it had no English to describe it. That's where we started. Number two was the questions of movements and denominationalism, because as the question of dynamic Judaism expands beyond the individual realm to the communal realm, groups organize, and those organizations usually take on names. The names shift, the personalities shift, the ideas themselves shift, but we don't usually exist in a vacuum. That's at least not a very Jewish tradition. Iconoclast Judaism is a very strange thing. It has existed, but isn't very useful to more than one person. Might not even be useful to that one person. But that's a question of denominationalism. That's not an answer, that's just a question. And for those who would like, I forgot to distribute at that class. It's a really cute chart that's part of a book by Elliot Dorff called From Our Ancestors to Our Descendants. And it is a chart, I might disagree with certain parts of it, but that stakes out the major denominations, including Reconstructionism, but not including Renewal. That's not where Dorff was thinking. And what they believe about Revelation, what they believe about the method of study, the authority of the Bibles and their ideas, and man's ability to change the Bible's laws and ideas. This will be a tease. You can't have this yet, but it's over here waiting. Okay. And Rabbi Robert Gamer, who's a dear friend of mine, put this together. Okay. The third conversation we had was called Rebels and Heretics, in which we talked about the introduction of new ideas and potentially radical shifts within any religious trajectory. And part of the question was, is healthy heresy what we believe as a Jewish community? Because, of course, all this theoretical stuff is interesting. But again, how useful is it to us here in the room in a practical sense? These ideas can be very, very fascinating. But unless they make my arms move and my legs move and my soul stir, they're just ideas. And so the goal of today is to recognize that the ideas can influence us, must influence us, and the question of tradition is one that should compel us. I was about to say command, but I don't want to scare you yet. So, what we're going to do today is based on, quote, a simple question by Rabbi Neil Gilman. He's going to be the scholar in residence for our Memorial Day biennial retreat. He has asked a question, and this was a particularly stormy night that he asked the question, why do some laws change and others not? He asked specifically, why are all cheeses kosher and not oysters? So the name of today's lecture is Why Not Oysters? In homage to him, because it's also a sexy-sounding topic, it gets people to shul. At the time, he also asked the question, why are there women rabbis but not gay rabbis? Thank God, because of much of the work that he had done nurturing the conversation, the response shifted in between the first time he asked the question and the second time he asked the question, and now today, when there are gay and lesbian rabbinical students in the conservative movement. I won't say more yet, except to say that his question is very important. As we begin to dwell on the question, why not oysters, what I want us to think about is, what would your answer to the question be? If we believe that tradition can change, because that's what we believe, tradition does change. You might not agree with me, we might go to different shuls, but in the end, Judaism is not today what it was back then, whenever then is. Because even in a shul that called itself conservative 50 years ago, there'd be no women leaders. The question of leadership might have shifted in terms of officership as opposed to ritual participation. All of that stuff might be true, but a conservative shul then did not look like a conservative shul today. Also in terms of the informality of the worship as it has shifted, we are, I find, a wonderful incarnation of a new trend in conservative Judaism, which is no bima Judaism. There is a certain hierarchy of ideas. Change does happen through process. We believe in bylaws, we believe in rabbinic authority. As contested as those things are at certain moments, we believe in them, sort of. But we don't need a bima to affirm a system of authority, because hierarchy need not be authoritarian if it's healthy. If we accept upon ourselves that there's a system. Because even the person who might be in the realm of lay leader or rabbi or whatever has a system that they are faithful to. They are authentic within. So there are changes, but not everything changes. Why not? Why not oysters? So, let's go on a little journey together. The sources that are on this sheet will lead us to talk about things that you don't have in front of you. These two books are the legal responsa of the conservative movement. The first volume is from 1980 to 1990. The second volume is from 1991 to 2000. None of them are excerpted on your pages. Some of them are available online, and the books are available for purchase where you see on the second side of the sheet I gave you the website that you could find it. Do not look on Amazon, they won't have it. One day when we have a book service that functions within the larger realm of the world, that will be the case. It will be available then, but for now we're institutionally insular, and that's part of the issue that leads to our topic. So, here we go. Reb Simcha Bunim was a tremendous Hasidic Rebbe. Rebbe as opposed to rabbi, because in the Hasidic world, the place of the Rebbe, of the spiritual leader, was much more exalted than the one that we would ascribe to any one person in our community. But he inherited a Hasidic movement largely shaped by someone named the Chozeh of Lublin, the Seer of Lublin in Poland. And the Chozeh of Lublin was a charismatic personality, and he turned the idea of Hasidic Judaism into a mass movement because he was so electric as a person. People followed him no matter what. But as part of that, they, in a certain sense, by his critics' description, were infantilized because they abdicated their own leadership of their own lives to their charismatic Rebbe. One of his students was simply called the Yehudi, the Jew. Why? Because he had the same name as his Rebbe and didn't want to be known to contest the name. So he's just the Yehudi, the Jew. He said, enough of this charismatic Judaism. You're still my Rebbe, but we've got to learn. Because what was sacrificed at the outset of the Chozeh of Lublin's Hasidic leadership was people's ability to own their own Jewish journeys. They didn't remember to struggle into the text to find the way. They looked to the miracle worker Rebbe for salvation. And in the poverty, the abject poverty that they lived, it's completely understandable. With the power of the Chozeh and his own integrity, it's not the way we would do it. I'm not questioning that authenticity, but for the Yehudi, that was not the way. The Yehudi was a powerful person, but not charismatic. His student was Rabbi Simcha Bunim, our character. So he's also from a town called Psishcha, and I just love saying Psishcha. So if you'd like to sound like you know what you're talking about, practice saying the word Psishcha, and people will say, ah, you know who he's talking about. Okay. So Rabbi Simcha Bunim was not only someone who followed his own Rebbe's instruction to go back to learning and to lead that, he was also someone exposed to the West, to modern life. So listen to this. While on a journey close to Warsaw, I knew that I had to tell about a certain incident, but it was something secular, because he went to the theater, he dressed not in Hasidic garb. I knew that it would be seen as a great joke if I told the story. My evil inclination said that I shouldn't tell the story, for I would lose the world, and they would no longer regard me as a Rebbe. Why could he not tell the secular story? because his own authority would be impugned in the eyes of his students. Would that really have been the case? We don't know. But what does it demonstrate? It demonstrates that authenticity is fickle. And his sense of authenticity was fragile. Because if he told a story that he knew, and the story would illustrate well his point, he still felt too scared to bring it in because people wouldn't look at him the same way anymore. But notice what he says. What inclination was it that made him afraid to tell the story? The evil inclination. It is the wrong part of me that leads me to be afraid to be myself as I lead. That's not what I'm supposed to draw strength from. If I'm worried about bringing this in because people might look at me differently, I have to wonder about myself as a leader, not wonder about them looking at me as a leader. Authenticity is not for the external world to decide. I'm going on my own path. There are other ways to interpret many of these sources, but I'm going to build a case and then I'll look down and read to you a little bit. But on the question of why some change happens and some change doesn't, the question of authenticity should come up quite a lot. If everything could change, if we believe that's the power that the human community has in Judaism, everything could change, why not? Why wouldn't it? And why shouldn't it? So Reb Simcha Bunim could be a place to derive one possible answer. Looking forward, Chancellor Gershon Cohen was the chancellor of the Jewish Theological Seminary when my father was there as a rabbinical student. This is the chancellor's address in a book called The Proceedings of the Rabbinical Assembly, that the Organization of Conservative Rabbis, from 1980. It's quoted in a very, very powerful piece by Rabbi Gordon Tucker called Can a People of the Book Also Be a People of God? It's in a recent issue of Conservative Judaism. If anyone would like copies of these things, you can ask me afterwards. I didn't want to do mass duplication of lots and lots of paper, but we can find a way for you to have that. Here's what he says. I frequently refer frequently to a verse from Psalm 119 that Maimonides used as the superscription to his Mishneh Torah. Rambam's Mishneh Torah, Rambam is Maimonides. His Mishneh Torah is a code of Jewish law. It was revolutionary in its own day, still revolutionary if you read it carefully. And he assumed upon himself, incredible amounts of authority without citing his sources and suggesting some radical innovations. That's why his books were burned in certain places. He now has become a core aspect of Jewish thought and learning, but when he was pushing his thoughts out, they were being pushed back quite a lot. So, Chester Cohen refers frequently to this quote of Maimonides, "As lo evosh behabiti el kol mitzvotecha." He translates this as, "Only when I contemplate the totality of the tradition can I hope to attain religious fulfillment." If you know Hebrew, you know that that's not what the Hebrew says. The Hebrew does not say something so positive. As lo evosh, therefore I won't despair. I won't be embarrassed. I won't be shamed. Behabiti el kol mitzvotecha, because I'm looking at all of your mitzvot, as I look at all your mitzvot. Right? So look what Cohen follows this with, but remember that the phrase actually is much more difficult than his translation makes it feel. Not everything we do, he's speaking to conservative rabbis, not everything we do is a fulfillment of the divine will, but everything must be measured by the divine will, and everything is either a response to or a retreat from it. I am worried about only one thing. Do we look as we believe we should look in terms of the most authentic interpretation of our heritage? You and I are rabbis, and he who fails to live up to his designated role is Kovesh Rabbanuto, a suppressor of his rabbinate. He suppressed his charge and withholds the message entrusted to him. He is thus a man who failed in his religious duty. Two things need to be said. One is that Chancellor Cohen is speaking before there is such a thing as a female rabbinical student in the conservative movement, and that Chancellor Cohen is the one who commissioned the report that led to the ordination of women as rabbis at JTS. So he's speaking only to a room full of men at that time, and he's enmeshed in this moment because in 1985 that commission was made. He's in the thick of the fight. They had to table the argument because it wasn't going anywhere in 1980. But he says, if you don't live the Judaism you believe you're supposed to be living, you are, and this is to religious authorities, not just to a membership of a movement, you are a kovesh rabbanutam. You are someone who has neglected your own calling. He didn't call it that, but I do. So again, the question, why not oysters? And it's so easy to use that, because no one's arguing for it. But let's, in your own minds, I don't need to invoke an idea, think about something that you either have wished would change or still wish would change about traditional Judaism. What holds that change back? Is it simply, Kovesh Rabbanuto, that the authorities in charge haven't implemented that change yet? Or is there something deeper than that, that even the authorities are called to? That is a very, very volatile topic, because where is the source of truth in that argument? Who's in charge, really? We'll talk about it. Are you okay so far? A lot of stuff. Looking for some nods so that I can move forward. Okay, good. Thanks for just giving in and nodding. Okay. Now, I rarely quote Rabbi Joel Roth, but it's not because he isn't brilliant. He is brilliant. It's just I disagree with him on almost everything. But he's an incredible icon of Menschlichkeit. Just personally with me, when I've said things that he finds distasteful, has come up to me both to correct me in his eyes and then to ask me if I'm okay. And so I want to give him full respect that he is a teacher of many, many hundreds of thousands of people. And even where I disagree with him quite aggressively, he has a tremendous amount of wisdom to share. And this is one of those examples of it. He's a product of the conservative movement, went to Camp Ramah, where he really found his own soul. Camp Ramah is the conservative movement's camping body. I went there myself. And he wrote this in a journal marking the 25th anniversary of the founding of Ramah. So he says, let me give one example of the difference between a halachist consultant and a halachist educator. So just for a second. Halachist is someone who gives legal decision, a posek. A halachic consultant, in his mind, is not the same as a halachist educator. So let's get to what he might mean. An abbreviated Birkat HaMazon, that's the blessing that we say after we eat bread, it is recited after each meal except for Shabbat, when the complete standard version is recited at two of the three meals. That's complicated. I don't exactly know why the decision was made. It only saves 3 minutes, really. But he's in charge, and he's about to show that's quite valid. I'm quite certain that any competent halachist consultant would have been able to indicate what the required elements of Birkat HaMazon are, would have been able to point out forms of it reflected in ancient Siddurim, and would have affirmed that one who recited such a version of Birkat HaMazon would indeed have fulfilled his legal obligation. Just to say it in English, Birkat HaMazon is this long in its standard form, but it has halakhically required components. So if you can do those components in this amount of text and time, is that sufficient, is the question that the halakhic consultant is asked. And any competent halakhic consultant would say, yes, that is sufficient. Look where he goes. A halachist educator, however, would have been very concerned with the other educational questions as well. God bless you. Do we want to convey the unmistakable message that whatever is halachically adequate is sufficient? How should we ensure that campers will not misperceive the full Birkat HaMazon as intended halachically for use only on Shabbat? Right? If all week long we do the smaller one, the sufficient but smaller, and then on Shabbat, two out of three meals, we do the longer one. What's the message? We do that in the middle. I grew up myself thinking that I washed hands for motzi on Shabbat, when in fact, I'm supposed to wash hands for motzi when I have motzi. How should we ensure that campers will not... How do we infuse into the very consciousness of the camp that heterim, that's the halakhic word for allowances, that were motivated by educational needs, that's the shortening of Birkat HaMazon, probably so you can have one more activity per day along that mindset, that the allowances were not intended to become normative for the entire conservative movement, were intended as starting points only, and that not everything that is halakhically defensible is necessarily halakhically desirable. Now, you can take that line any number of ways. if we believe that our power to change law is unlimited, then this applies to every question. And must apply to every question, because just because you might have that theoretical power doesn't mean exercising it is just. In Rabbi Roth's experience, when he responded to the tshuvot, the legal responder that allowed gay ordination, he discredited the halachic argumentation of the permissive tshuvot. It might be said, and this is a reach, but one that occurred to me as I was preparing for today, that he believes that it's halachically defensible to allow for gay ordination and gay marriage, but it's not desirable. So the question of subjectivity in the part of the posik is quite important, and I don't know that that's what his thoughts were. But this question is salient regardless of which situation we're talking about. Because in the case of Birkat HaMazon, wrong messages are conveyed. If you create a system where the shortened version is a weekday experience, the wrong lessons are learned. Are they of the same import as the gay inclusion question and Jewish law? No, they are not. Because it is, now I'm speaking as an advocate, it is insufficient to limit halakha when it creates indignity in an individual's life and doesn't need to.
I just asked the question, when you talk about changing law, mm-hmm. are you talking about changing Torah law or changing rabbinic law?
Good. I'm just asking about the distinction in halakha between the word de'oraita and the word de'rabanan. De'oraita is a category of Jewish law that is derived from the Bible's authority, and derabbanan is a category of Jewish law that refers to rabbinic sources of authority. I don't believe there is actually such a distinction between the two. Because inasmuch as there historically is a divide between the two, the question of whether we believe the Torah was divinely written is actually the question implied in that distinction. If we believe that the Torah is a composite document of human yearning, that's my definition of it, then the difference between earlier human yearning and later human yearning is a matter of chronology and not of authority. Because if we presume that the older something is, the more authoritative it is, we couldn't introduce any changes. So your question is grounded and quite traditional in its orientation. My response is grounded in a more progressive sense of tradition. And the origins of the Torah are quite important in this conversation too, because changing something that is explicit in the Torah is actually the hardest thing to do. It's not that we don't have the authority to, it's that the onus of an argument is so much heavier when something is explicit in the Torah, which is why in the conservative movement's recent decisions about gay inclusion or ordination, even the permissive tshuva written by Elliot Dorf, Danny Nevins, and Avram Reisner still prohibited male anal intercourse. Not male-male relationships, but because the Torah is explicit about an act, not a relationship, they only went so far. For advocates like me, that was insufficient. But it's a step forward for the right reasons, but based on a traditional question like yours. And especially since conservative halakha must be connected to a community's consensus and readiness, and we're going to get to that too, their step forward was wiser than my writing might have been. So I'm not in any way rejecting your question. I'm just putting it into a context. Anyone else so far? As a what?
I'm sorry. I said it's to go on with what you're saying, that oysters are okay.
So Ethel's point is actually quite important, which is why I'm asking the question. Oysters might be okay, according to what I was thinking. I'll give you the shorthand answer, which is incredibly violent as a response, but I'll give it in the name of the person who said it. Rabbi Steve Greenberg, who wrote the book Wrestling with God and Men, Judaism and Homosexuality, has been asked that question a lot because he is an advocate for inclusion. So someone says, always, in every gathering, so why not cheeseburgers? And he says, because no one ever committed suicide over a cheeseburger. And that is the response. That is, for me, one of the more formative responses I've heard, not only because it's coming from a living incarnation of that tension between inherited tradition and life experience, because he himself is a gay Orthodox rabbi, but because it's true. Because if the impact of a law is a loss of life, health, or dignity, which I think are actually all within the category of pikuach nefesh, of saving a life, which trumps every issue of Jewish law except three. Right, those three being idol worship, forced incest or rape, and committing murder yourself. Right, those you must die and not do, even under duress. Because there's a big difference between oysters, which is a culinary appetite, and the sexuality that I am. And I think that's an incredibly, incredibly important distinction. Okay?
I do too. However, tradition has both ignored or allowed us not to do certain laws that are written in the Torah.
Correct.
And tradition has also made it much more, put many more boundaries on laws that are written in the Torah. Kashrut being one with many more boundaries than if you look at the original Torah. And the whole issue of mixing garments is, I don't know anyone who does that today. And on a more violent note, the issue of punishment for adulterers or other things.
Good.
So it's not that we're not changing laws, either to make them more or less restrictive.
I'm going to hold on to that question because it's within the context of the whole conversation. But I want to point out how correct Joan is also in concert, not just with what Edna said, but in general, the Jewish traditional approach to laws that are listed in the Torah is maybe not to add or subtract, as Deuteronomy tells us not to, but to create fences, siyagim, around them so that we don't end up violating them. Whether or not those fences are meant to be inviolate or just buffers, or whether or not we are willing to subject ourselves to a commanding tradition which we will acknowledge is humanly created, or whether or not we are willing to delineate between something that is divinely created and the fences that protect us from the violation of the divine will. All of that is part of the mix. Ultimately, the question, I think, comes to us as to when one question comes up regarding Jewish law, what do we do and why? Which begins with, what do we believe ourselves to be? In Chancellor Cohen's words, are we living the Judaism that we believe we're supposed to? And what leads us to believe that we have that choice and that obligation? If we believe that we have that obligation, then I will assert every moment of my life, I think, that we have both the responsibility and the power to be the arbiters of Jewish law, at least on the communal level, and perhaps with many communities that might be or might not be like-minded, create a consensus for what Judaism in a movement or a world must be. These are questions that are incredibly relevant, not only because insufficient answers hurt people and alienate others, meaning hurt a lot of people, but they also make us question what our commitments are if we don't have a voice in them. The voice might be an accepting voice, but why? What leads me to accept a rule that I would rather not follow? Case in point, and again, totally mundane. Pesach just ended. Every day I came to shul, and that was every day, I walked past the bread workshop, and boy, did that smell good. So why not? Why not? And in a diaspora that follows 2 days of the holiday at the end and at the beginning, based on an inability to communicate the calendar well, now that we have the calendar, why am I holding 2 days? And within Pesach, the tradition of not having legumes, kitniot, which is an Ashkenaz stringency because we couldn't tell mustard seeds from wheat. Why am I still following that tradition, even though I know, and in the conservative movement, there's a shuvah that says I don't need to. The confusion is over. Why do I still do that? I want to hold on to these questions because the fences, the boundaries, the difference between custom and law, between rabbinic law and biblical law, the place I see myself as having and inhabiting within my relationship with Judaism and with God, whatever God means, all this is very, very relevant. I want to look down because we're going to have a good conversation, but I want to make sure that we have it with as much information, at least that I was intending us to have, as possible. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks is text 4. He is the chief rabbi of Great Britain. I don't agree with everything he says either, but he's incredibly, incredibly wise as an author and as a leader. This is in a book called Celebrating Life, quoted in a book called Inspired Jewish Leadership by Dr. Erica Brown, who's a scholar in residence at the Federation of Greater Washington. She's a dear teacher of mine. We have to be prepared to change. The trouble is, consistently today, we hear the argument that human beings cannot change. The family's breaking down? Inevitable. Civility is on the wane? That's how things are. Too much violence in the media? If that is what people want, that's what they get. None of these is true. Why are they said? Because we have focused on institutions that reinforce rather than change human behavior. Governments reflect votes, politics follow opinion polls, the market mirrors consumer choices. There is only one thing missing from this constellation. It is the language of aspiration. The idea that whatever we are, we might be different. We can grow and develop. We are not simply a bundle of desires. We have immortal longings. So let's hold on to that. That is change in a different direction than we usually argue for. That's a response to a change. That's a response to the dynamism which is the loosening of solidity, of balance. I have to quote Heschel because I just have to. This is in a wonderful book called Conservative Judaism and Jewish Law, edited by Seymour Siegel. Heschel has a number of different essays on halakha. This one was chosen for that book by Seymour Siegel because Heschel was speaking, when he originally gave this speech, to the group called the Central Conference of American Rabbis, which is the organization of Reform Rabbis. He originally, when he came to the States, was faculty for the Reform Rabbinical School in Cincinnati, Hebrew Union College. He left for a number of reasons, including the fact that he couldn't eat in the cafeteria. There are many other reasons. But he was invited back to talk to the group that he had been the teacher for, and here was his opportunity to say something. And so instead of the revised versions that were within the conservative movement discussed, this is the one that he shared with the Reform Rabbinical Organization. What is the Jewish way to God? It is not a way of ascending the ladder of speculation. Our understanding of God is not the triumphant outcome of an assault upon the riddles of the universe, nor a donation we receive in return for intellectual surrender. Our understanding comes by way of the mitzvah. By living as Jews, we attain our faith as Jews. We do not have faith in deeds, we attain faith through deeds. When Moses recounted to the people the laws of the covenant with God, the people responded, Na'aseh v'nishma, we will do and we will hear. This statement was interpreted to mean, in doing, we perceive. A Jew is asked to take a leap of action rather than a leap of thought. To surpass his needs, to do more than he understands in order to understand more than he does. In carrying out the word of the Torah, he is ushered into the presence of spiritual meaning. Through the ecstasy of deeds, he learns to be certain of the presence of God. Jewish law is a sacred prosody. The divine sings in our deeds. The divine is disclosed in our deeds. Our effort is but a counterpoint in the music of God's will. In exposing our lives to God, we discover the divine within ourselves and its accord with the divine beyond ourselves. This requires multiple rereadings. I need to reread this many, many times. So instead of commenting on it, I will just be in awe with you of its poetry and potential meanings. The final quote, this is from a book called Expanding the Palace of Torah, Orthodoxy in Feminism. One of the reasons I wanted to include it is because as I looked over my source sheet, there were no women's voices. And I am upset about that. This is not tokenism that includes Tamara Ross. In fact, she is the rebuttal to many of the arguments that I make myself. But she, in the Orthodox world, has become one of the prominent voices where feminism and orthodoxy might meet, a group called JOFA, Jewish Orthodox Feminist Alliance. So here's what she writes. The existence of halakhic strategies, such as those just described above, she talks about some other halakhic responses when change was requested, but not known if it was possible, plays into the widespread notion that a solution can be found to almost every basic halakhic difficulty given the proper institutional circumstances, which is to say, general consensus of opinion among a recognized community of major rabbinic authorities. She's saying in English is, any change is possible if the situation is correct. A by now notorious slogan first coined by Blue Greenberg, where there is a rabbinic will, there is a halakhic way, is probably meant to express this faith in the halakhic system's ability to rise to the challenges of modernity. Nonetheless, the rather cavalier attitude to due process of law that this slogan seems to imply, omitting as it does any reference to limitations upon the nature of such solutions, has raised the ire of rabbinic authorities. Such an attitude continues to serve as a red flag. It ignores the fact that beyond the objective political and historical constraints mentioned earlier, another more subjective and ideological factor is extremely influential. The perceptions of the halachic decisor himself and of his community, here's a sentence, as to just how far he may legitimately take his interpretations. The word legitimately is incredibly loud. She's hesitant to say that anything is possible, but she acknowledges that just about anything could be possible if the posek and the community, for us, the rabbi and community, believe that it is legitimate. It is not whether or not we believe that it's possible. It's whether or not we believe that it's legitimate. So again, Simcha Bunim is scared to tell a secular story because he will lose his standing. But that's his evil inclination. He does dress the way he does, and he does speak the way he does, and he does go to the theater, and he is a Rebbe. We do have men and women sit together. We do have categories of membership for Jews and non-Jews. We do believe in gay marriage. We are who we are. We believe those things are legitimate. Could we say the same things about oysters? No. Because it's not a legitimate change.
What makes a change legitimate?
So you answer the question.
And it sounds like what makes it legitimate is that the subject matter is not trivial. And possibly based on what you said before about did anyone commit suicide over it, all the laws of kashrut are, by that standard, trivial. Nothing depends on them. So why change them?
Yeah.
Which seems to me is a specious argument.
Okay, so let's attack it. Let's attack it. Let it run first.
Why is bread trivial?
Good.
Nobody died because they were forced to eat cheese.
Why is rennet trivial or why is swordfish necessary is the same question, because the conservative movement has ruled within the past decades that swordfish is kosher and rennet is not meat anymore. I'm not arguing whether or not it's an authentic decision. I'm wondering whether or not it's important for us to be discussing when there are other things that require attention. One of the things that needs to be pointed out is Elliot Dorf does in a book called For Love of God and People, A Philosophy of Jewish Law, is that when he looked at Rabbi Joel Roth's legal response, which allowed the ordination of women as rabbis, there was one word missing the entire time through. Not once did Rabbi Roth mention morality. He argued for the change which allowed for women's ordination because it could happen, not because it should happen. So again, I'm not saying that questions of kashrut are trivial all the time. But the legitimacy of the inclusion of oysters in the context of a tradition that gives meaning for those who are looking for it, the authority of the system is based on a legitimate Jewish path towards meaning. What we believe about the word command as individuals, what we believe, that is very much part of this conversation, such as the distinction between biblical law and rabbinic law. That feeds all of our potential responses. So, I'm coming from the standpoint that tradition stands until it doesn't anymore. But if someone's asking me to defend tradition, the answer is, it's beautiful. I can't make anyone and wouldn't make anyone do anything. But my experience of tradition is that it's deeply meaningful. I'm very settled within the craziness of Pesach. It's crazy. But I don't struggle to figure out if it's worth it. I live with it, and as I struggle sometimes because it's worth it, I wonder what I'm doing. And in wondering what I'm doing, I come closer to my own sense of where God is in the world. It might be the same for some people. It's following the grains of wood until they find peace. Because if that's a legitimate tradition that gives meaning to your life, why change it? So the question is not, as an individual, how do I feel commanded by God or tradition to follow kashrut? The question is, when should Judaism change its stance on a position? Is that based on a person's desire to live within, to live beyond the system because it isn't meaningful for them? Or is it based on the community's sense that the law is insufficient to our sense of what is right? Tradition's hold on an individual person is different than the question of when change is necessary. And in fact, that's part of my entire point. By using the phrase dynamic Judaism, what I'm trying to argue for a community where we are not uniform in practice and not uniform in our belief, not uniform in our sense of commandedness even, that we might take for granted, and I think we do, that change is possible. How many times have I been asked since I got here to allow instrumental music on Shabbat? 4 or 5. And I don't, that's all. And you're like, oh, really, that's all? And why not? And why not? And the answer is based on what I believe a legitimate traditional Jewish choice is. Does that delegitimize other places that use musical instruments? No, not at all. I don't delegitimize the choice of other rabbis to perform marriages for Jews and non-Jews. I don't delegitimize that. I don't do that. It's not what I feel I'm called to be and do in the world based on what my community and my movement and my convictions lead me to believe personally. I'm part of something much larger than self. And though it pains me at moments to say no to questions, I have no choice. Because for me to concede to the need of an individual to live beyond the system that is mine is to sacrifice the system. I will make exceptions and make referrals to other rabbis and others and other authorities and say, this is the way we observe as a community. We are not the only great place in town. And I would love you to find, I say this over and over, I would love you to find your home here. But if you can't, that doesn't mean you're not finding home. I celebrate home, and we are not the only home. That means there are multiple avenues towards legitimate Jewish living. But our expression, I believe, take certain things more seriously than others. And so kashrut we take very seriously as a community. What we as individuals do is different than our communal aspirations, using Rabbi Sachs's language. What do we aspire to? Meaningful living in every aspect. So I could go on for a while, and I was holding you back from a response.
It just seems to me that there are certain aspects of the law that hold the whole body of the law up to ridicule because they are silly, in my view.
Yeah. Do you say the same thing about shaking the lulav? Because it's really silly. And if you've ever done it, no, I don't want to hear about lulav. And if you've ever shaken the lulav and allowed it to shake you back, there's a moment of strangeness and maybe connectivity in the most weird of ways. If lulav is strange and yet glorious, if davening in Aramaic sometimes on Shabbat is weird but musical and cool, if making sure, and you know, I'm pointing to ritual things as opposed to ritual interpersonal things, if the mitzvah of granting dignity to someone. Now, I don't want to think of trivial examples because they're too real and too present in our community. The question of when law doesn't achieve meaning for me personally, what then is law, is a different kind of question. Kafka deals with that quite a lot, actually. I see a bunch of hands, so we're going to keep on talking, but I don't want to ignore Ron and then David.
So Rabbi Sachs also says we're not just simply by rule of desires. So when, you know, you uphold the laws of, you know, Pesach, when, you know, you're expressing a discipline, and whether you give it meaning or not, you still have the history of everybody who's done it before you and the people who do it, you know, you're doing it now and the people in front of you. So to the extent that any discipline, there may be absurd. It's still a respect that we're not simply a bundle of desires. And it is that we can project our own meaning into it. And so, in the sense of why not use voices, you could say, well, you know, it's not, none of this is belittling our human dignity. If we choose to eat breakfast or not, it doesn't make us a better, you know, or worse person. What we can say, it is that we're not simply a bundle of desires. To the extent that you do make a commitment, and it has meaning, that it gives you a different set of dignity than if you're always acting out every which way.
And if the you is not only the individual you.
Yeah, it's not the individual you.
Okay. Thank you. David.
I'm a little troubled by the answer. that I contained that comment is that I can accept what you say that the Torah is not like, even accept that the Torah is not this divinely handed down kind of stuff, that we have all the stuff that comes after, but it's merely chronological order. It's more than just the knowledge, it's a set of things that we've chosen to make order for you, more serious. It's also older, which means that don't mess with stuff that people have been arguing about and thinking about for 3,000 years as opposed to stuff that people have been reading about for 10 years. And so in essence you're saying, look, we've thought about this message for a long time. And so some of the older ones are hard to change simply because what really makes you think you haven't thought this is what your idea has been thought through and argued through and resolved 1,000 years ago.
Right.
So the answer in some sense is because the voice is cheese is easier than oysters because the whole rationale behind it is less certain than the fact that oysters can have a simple declaration, don't eat that stuff, right? And no one has come up in all the years with some way to kind of say, well, just don't eat that stuff, but under the following circumstances.
I would actually, I'm just only going to interject, because it might be that no one has said, here's the way to re-understand it. No one has said, we must find a way to re-understand it. The closest we've had is Reform Judaism rejection of kashrut. As meaningless. Right? So the why is actually much more important than the how. I agree with you, by the way. I don't think we're disagreeing. That ancient tradition, meaning biblical tradition, is much harder and must be much harder than rabbinic tradition to change. But at no moment does that mean that I am powerless in the face of biblical tradition. It means I have to work a lot harder.
I'm not arguing that. I'm saying that it's much harder.
Yeah.
Because it has so much history behind it.
Yeah.
And we kind of make that distinction simple by giving it this cachet of, oh, this was handed down in Sinai.
Right.
As opposed to this was ushered by a bunch of guys that make up.
By the way, the other example, can somebody go upstairs and shut the door? That'd be really useful. Sorry. Okay, yeah. Oh, those are visitors. We'll just make sure they know to go upstairs. The other example, and it's funny, David, I'm speaking to you because of Martha's passion and dedication. The other example in Jewish tradition of the word Mi-Sinai, coming out as a tradition meaning from Sinai, is that when melodies have existed long enough that no one can tell you where it came from, they are authoritative using the system of Mi-Sinai. This is a Mi-Sinai melody. And you might go to communities where changing the melody is much harder than changing Jewish law. Because what gives you your sense of self? When we get to Be'an Arachetz, again, that Aramaic combination of words, as we open the Torah, if anyone changes the melody, it is really hard to sing along with them, because no, I know the melody to that. Don't change it. It's meaningful to me, to us. We got more of us, and then Edna.
I know that we don't differentiate, but why not between sticking to custom laws that have some kind of a meaning attached versus laws that come to us just because they're in the Torah? So the example would be, you know, milk and meat, don't, you know, put your kid in your mother's milk and pitch it because it's a way to remember Genesis.
So to your question, I'm going to give a trite answer, but I think within the trite answer is somewhat of a response. As soon as we get to Shulchan Aruch in the Seder, some of us have an egg. In my family, growing up, all the cousins, of which I was the oldest, would have the egg white, but we all hated egg yolks. So my Saba, Zichrono Livracha, my grandfather, would collect all of the egg yolks and mix them with some of the salt water and drink the whole thing down. I found that revolting. To this day, I find the taste revolting, but every Pesach, as soon as we get to Shulchan Aruch, since he died, I do it. And every time I do it, I cry. And I think there's a difference between the system of Jewish law that we uphold for no reason and the one that we inherit and we challenge. Again, I have established that egg yolk halacha for myself. It's not a psach for anybody else, but I could never escape it. It is Pesach. And it's pretty recent in the scheme of things, but it is a command. The difference between that and challenging an established rule of the Torah is profound. Pesedik, forget the egg yolk, which is personal to me, Pesedik rules are very strange. What we need to do, what we don't need to do, you know, in my house, you don't need to do contact paper, depending on what your counters are made out of. Why did I beg my wife to go get contact paper? Because when the kids came downstairs, they'd know it was Pesach. And so would I, because as a child, I saw it. And when she said, what kind do I need to get? I said, get the ugliest possible contact paper. Because it creates the distinction, which is needless, but generates the inquisitiveness, the curiosity, the deeply Jewish experience of wondering what you're doing. And that is different than rejecting a rule in the Torah because it tastes good. Or I've never had it, but my yen has always been for a cheesesteak. I always wanted a cheesesteak.
What?
Don't tell me if it's worth it.
A what?
But a cheesesteak, a Philly cheesesteak in particular. I don't know what it is, but it's... But my point is... But my point is, I've always wanted one.
Go for it.
Delete that. My point is that changing tradition is different than upholding one. And upholding a tradition that comes from, quote, meaninglessness, or happenstance, or subjectivity, or family, or community. Right? Changing that is very painful. And it should be no less painful to challenge a more ancient inherited tradition. In fact, it should be more. And so even though kashrut, in some ways, is so difficult to accept, let alone implement, the why behind it is, for me, more important. The how comes from the why. I'm going to hold that intention for a moment and look back at Fran. Oh, I'm sorry, I said Edna and then Fran. Sorry.
I wanted to say, some of what you're saying to 500 years from now,
yeah,
and the inherent danger in doing this.
Yeah,
I've never had an oyster in my life, you know, and made it to middle age, so that's obviously not a crucial issue. But you're swinging back and forth between the community and our community.
Yes.
And what that leads to is, first of all, there's a general community, maybe the JTS or the scholars, that make the decisions for the rest of us about what's moral or what we can change and what we can't. Then we talk about our community, and in our community we have certain things, and this was true even in Eastern Europe, you know, before the war. The rabbi would decide halachically what you could do and what you can't. But then this would lead the population to shop around. Well, let's see, in this community, I can eat oysters because they've changed that law, but in this community, I have to follow. So that it's like you're looking for a winter coat sale, you know, when you're shopping for the Jewish community, which one has changed or not changed the laws enough. But more important than that, what the Jews changed, changed the definition of Judaism at the destruction of the First Temple completely. And I'll be looking at that again, say, 200 or 300 years from now. If we change Torah law, what are we going to have instead? And are we still going to be...
I don't want to answer your question because I think it's the right question. I will, however, say that if we stand passive in the moments where we think we should be acting, we are Kovesh Rabbanuto. I am paralyzed by my fear of the future, of a slippery slope argument into an inaction. And I think that is deeply wrong. I am afraid of the future, but not because I think it's going to go wrong, but because I always want to resemble my great-grandchildren. And the Jew that I am would be very, very foreign to my great-great-grandparents, certainly to Rabbi Akiva, and definitely to Moses. But my son is named for Moses. And we teach Rabbi Akiva. I'm pretty sure using Jewish drum circles in the desert for Pesach, which was a recent experience of one community local to ours, that that is so alien to the shtetls of Eastern Europe. And 500 years from now, will be... might be halakhic. Or might be just as untranslatable as being in the desert with Moses is for us. But we are Judaism. What you're pointing out, however, and I don't want to answer it, I just want to amplify it, is that there's a difference between local communal decision-making and Judaism as a whole. And the problem is that there's really... it's very hard to make an argument for Judaism as a whole. Kaplan tried, Judaism is a civilization. And I actually think that if people act with authenticity, and I'm going to use that word a lot, when they shop around for a community, that's actually a good thing. The Pew Foundation had a study that came out about a year ago that pointed out that 25% of people who affiliate with faith today are affiliating with a faith they did not find themselves born to. Which means that 25% of the current faith community are choosing their own place. And I actually find within the infinity that I believe to be God enough space for that to be authentic. If that is true, Judaism to Islam to Christianity to Buddhism as a philosophy, even if it's not exactly a religion, if that is a path towards purposeful, healthy living, and I know that's totally subjective, who am I to call it inauthentic? In the same sense, every one of those brands has its own authenticity to live up to. So I'm going to hold on to that. I'm going to look back to Fran, go to Carol, Rita, and then I'm looking down again. Who did I say first, Fran?
I'm thinking about what you're saying in the context of a woman having credit in her own name to buy a house, or the Voting Rights Act, or, integrated schools. I think that these are huge societal changes that then became law, federal law. And I think that as society changes, there are a myriad of things that happen until the federal or global law changes. And I think there are nature shifts that we become comfortable with over centuries of time. If you said to any woman in this conversation, you can't have credit in your own name, pardon the pun, I think that we would all look and say, oh, that's really interesting, but not here.
Right. By the way, one of the things you pointed out is one of the critiques I have of Jonathan's, Rabbi Sacks's quote. When he talks about institutions that reinforce rather than change human behavior, he says governments reflect votes, and that's true. But I would like to believe that government is an aspirational institution too. And personally, I agree. But the historical circumstance that surrounds and builds up to change is experienced differently at different moments. So, for instance, when Prop 8 passed, I found that we failed as an aspirational community of Californians. And the fact that all the demographic studies of the voter turnout demonstrated that within 20 years, it's a slam dunk that equal marriage will be law in California, I found the difference between a victory now and a victory then, judging it only from now and as a straight ally, as opposed to someone who's suffering personally with my own relationship, I found that to be a loss of aspirational communal life. So there are lots of things building up to it. So when Governor Patterson in New York introduced legislation, I think he took a major step forward because that was law leading the way. And of course, there have been presidents in our history, recent history, who called that judicial activism. But judicial activism is actually Jewish tradition. The question is, do you do it with integrity and therefore less willingness, depending on the category of law that you are trying to challenge? The authenticity of the challenge is incredibly important. All right, so I'm going to hold on to that thought and not really answer it except to say, yes, you certainly should have credit in your own real estate.
I think that what our discussion is kind of looking at it, for the most part, as if we're in a very small world, not only of Jews, but of Jews who are taking seriously. And not that I have an answer to the question, but at least want to pose the question that I'm much more likely to be asked, not why not oysters, but why shouldn't we eat oysters?
Right.
I agree completely that there's no ethical reason to change the oysters as there is about heterosexist, transsexist aspects of halakha. But for most Jews, that's not the main question.
Agreed.
That they're asking, and so it should be just to put out there, just to broaden our discussion,
yeah,
not to answer it. And the other thing I want to do is broaden our discussion even more. I feel like every time I come to one of these, I bring this point up, so maybe that's my role, which is to look at the broader social forces outside of the Jewish world, which we are, it's not that we're just, this is not happening internal to the Jewish world.
Right.
There's a reason that there was a long fight about the community of women and men, inclusivity of gays and lesbians, because of the greater social thing that is happening in the world. Like a lot of non-Jewish actors, gays and lesbians, and non-Jewish women, as well as Jewish women, were out there advocating for change, and that message got filtered down to where we in the Jewish world are responding to that.
Yeah.
And that's appropriate, that should happen, but we can't see it any of that.
Agreed. By the way, the best place, you've probably seen this also, the best article that addresses that question is called Judaism in an Age of Permeable Boundaries by Rachel Adler in the Reconstructionist Journal about 8 years ago, 9 years ago. Certainly. But I want to make sure that whereas we do not exist in a vacuum, we also don't abdicate our responsibilities to be who we are in the context. Because there are times, as Sachs says, that change dilutes who we are in the world because we could just give in and capitulate. And I don't want to become that. Saying no is very hard, but incredibly important sometimes. All right, I said one more person was going to say, Rita, Yon, I'm sorry, I pointed to Rita.
This might be malignant heresy instead of helping heresy.
Yeah, yeah.
But I know the Torah is so deep on this point, but you linked idol worship, forced incest, and murder.
Yeah, I know.
And inside of me, I don't link the first with the other two. So I think...
Yeah. The rabbis linked idol worship to gilui arayot, to those forced sexual relationships, and to murder. Because in terms of paramount definition of what it was to be a Jew in the world and faithful to God, idol worship was translated as cheating on God. Theological monogamy is the ideal, and cheating on God is the sin. And adultery to God is lined up in their hearts and souls to adultery to your partner, then to your spouse. Let me just hold the question up. I'll just acknowledge the question. What I'd like to do, and we're not going to have time to do this well, but that's also why I showed you where you could buy these books yourself. A, because I think it gives rise to a renewed notion that conservative Judaism is worthwhile and thoughtful. And the world doesn't always see it that way, is to show that these two are tomes, and they are expensive, but they are rich. And I quoted just a sample of the titles that are in here, and I'll look with you at two of them.
Those
are not yet in our library, but if you'd like to make a donation, I will tell you, seriously, anybody would like to make a donation, these are really worthwhile new volumes that we don't have yet. Okay. So the two volumes I have here are not the only ones. There are other ones, but these are the two most recently collected. 1980 to 1990, these are based, if you see in the parentheses after each title, based on classic codes of Jewish law, beginning with the Tor, but the place you see it most often is called the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, which was codified by Rabbi Yosef Karo, who lived in Egypt and then in Tzfat, in northern Israel. We'll be visiting his shul for those who are coming on the shul trip in August. It was codified in the year 1563, but only published in 1565. And he gave the same four columns to Jewish law that the Tor, a code by Rabbi Yaakov ben Asher, had given it before. All that means to say, here's the categories in front of you. When you see the citation beginning with O-H, that's Or HaChaim, which means the path of life, and that usually deals with daily ritual and synagogue practice, including prayer. If you see the citation begin with Y-D, that's Yoredea, and that is on aspects of sort of personal status and institution building. H-M is Choshen Mishpat, that's jurisprudence and civil law, from a Jewish perspective. And the other category is only in column two. It's EH, Eben Ha'ezer, which is about human relationships, usually about wedding and divorce. You can see by the titles that these are very far-ranging, but just imagine being in the group discussing this. And some of the conversations actually are recorded. There's a wonderful three-volume proceeding of Proceedings of the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards, edited by Rabbi David Glinkin. It's from it's 1927 to 1970. But the best part of it is you can see the conversations going on. You can see people arguing about the authenticity of their very discussing it. When it comes to the driving to shul issue, when it comes to something called the Lieberman Clause, which impacted the way Jews got married, their nervousness, like Simcha Bunim's, about what they might do and what impact it would have on the perception of them, specifically by the Orthodox world, because at that time, conservative Judaism was afraid of not being Orthodox. I don't think we have that problem anymore. I think we need to define ourselves with solidity and legitimacy, but not to prove ourselves to anyone else other than ourselves, which we have a while to go, I think, as a movement, before we believe that. So, here's a list of topics that I was going to talk about, but I'm not going to begin delving into because it will be inadequate. I'll just mention a few in depth when we get there. Commemorating the Shoah, the question was raised, it's in the 1980 volume, about the Federation of Jewish Men's Clubs, which is the men's groups of most conservative shuls, created a ritual in New England where they were going to send to every member of the Federation of Jewish Men's Clubs, it was a serious number of thousands of people, a candle for the Shoah, and they were going to have a little card describing the ritual that you do when you light it, including a bracha that started with Baruch Ata Adonai. Fascinating, because the middle part of it says, Asher Kitshana B'mitzvotav V'tzivanu, who commanded us, God who commanded us to do this mitzvah and light a candle to remember the Shoah. So some of you are nodding saying no, but let me ask you a question. You don't think God wants you to remember the Shoah as a Jew? Like, what do you believe about God? That God only cared about things that happened during the times of the Torah? In fact, we light a candle saying, Asher Kitshana B'mitzvotav V'tzivanu, about lighting Hanukkah candles, which didn't happen in the times of the Tanakh. It's in the Apocrypha in the Book of Maccabees, but it's not in the Jewish Bible. And we say, Asher Kitshanu. So the discussion is about whether or not halakhically you're allowed to create a new blessing. And the end of the tshuva, I'm paraphrasing, please look it up yourselves. I'm paraphrasing, but it says, it is laudatory to create a ritual. And we commend the Federation of Jewish Men's Clubs. The accompanying liturgical phrase should not include Baruch Atah Adonai or Eloheinu Melech HaOlam, but should invoke God and memory and bring us close in every Jewish way. What is that? That is saying we can change everything, but to be legitimate we do it in certain ways. It, however, also is a theological statement that we are not the arbiters of what God wants to be doing in the world. Fascinating. I'm not commenting on it, I'm just reflecting it, hopefully doing justice to it. The next topic is the annual and triennial systems for reading the Torah. The annual system for reading the Torah is you read every Torah portion in its entirety, in sequence, and year to year you read the entire Torah ending on Simchat Torah. In the ancient world, there was a triennial cycle, where you finish the Torah every 3 years, differently than we do it. The way they used to do it is, week A, you read the first third of the Torah portion of Bereshit, of Genesis. Week B, you read the second third. Week C, you read the third third, which means it takes a lot longer to get through each book, and you only finish the entire cycle by Simchat Torah. The way we do it, and many conservative rituals, is based on this argument, which is that we read the first third of the Torah, first third of every portion of the Torah within a given calendar year. Have we read the entire Torah by the end of the year? No. So what's Simchat Torah for us? We didn't read the whole thing. I find the argument for triennial reading to be based on not wanting Torah to take such a long time because services go on forever, but also because it's very difficult to learn and do well. But how can you read the Torah and on the week that is about the binding of Isaac not read the binding of Isaac? How could you read Revelations week and not read Revelation? How can you do that? So anyway, this tshuva talks about all of that stuff and ends up legitimizing the practice that we have currently, with one exception. When it comes to the end of a book of the Torah, you don't say Chazak, Chazak, V'nit Chazek. We will be strong, and we will be strengthened because we didn't really finish it. It's only in the third year that we would say Chazak, Chazak, V'nit Chazek, and we do say Chazak, Chazak, V'nit Chazek. Again, I'm not judging, I'm just mirroring. The next one. Tape recording and photography on Shabbat. This one was written by Rabbi Meir Rabinowitz and by Adam Weisberg's sister. If you know Adam's a member of the shul, his sister Devorah Weisberg is a co-author of this tshuva. And they are talking about both the dignity and the spiritual impact on the moment of photography or recording of services that happen on Shabbat. They're also talking about the ancient concept that you must not write, record anything on Shabbat, and whether or not the digital impact of a, they didn't have DVDs when they were writing the tshuva, the digital impact onto the tape of a cassette tape or of a photograph, which they say, besides Polaroid, all you have is the latent picture. Now that's not exactly true, although the digital photo we have is latent, I guess, and they're talking about whether or not it's advisable, and the only thing that makes them want to say yes, though they say no in the end, the only thing that makes them want to say yes is, what if you have a family member who can't be there? Wouldn't you want to record it so that they could experience it? And they feel pain and they say no. Not judging, just telling. Here's another one. And this is useful in a time like today. A question of great interest. May a synagogue issue interest-bearing bonds? The answer, by the way, is yes, but be very careful. Based on halachic business practices. And the tshuva ends up saying, yes, you may, but make sure you don't just do it. Make it an educational opportunity. Study this tshuva and study the sources so that people don't feel illegitimate in what they're doing, because the Jewish concept of interest is a problem. Ribit is the biblical concept of taking interest. But through a business arrangement which is not usury, not abusive, it's not the interest of the Bible. Again, that was David Left, but how do we figure it out? Again, not judging, just telling. Here's another one. Statement on gambling. You and I might think that the answer is a slam dunk. How many of you, in your experiences, saw churches or synagogues around you as you were growing up that had bingo nights? You guys are from California. I had it my whole life. Right? And then when we banned smoking, we lost the whole... well, thanks. But bingo's gambling. And gambling is problematic. And the Jewish concept, don't put a stumbling block before the blind. This is a value judgment. This is not about oysters. This is about, should we permit something that could cause disease or exacerbate disease or take advantage of people's vulnerabilities in our shuls? When there's a Texas Hold'em fundraiser for a shul, isn't that the same thing? Okay. Co-ops for kosher meat is about two things. One of them is about whether or not local communities can be relied upon to create a co-op successfully, and whether or not that's good for the Jewish community, but it's raised in the context of, it's called Hasagat Gvul, crossing over a boundary, which is business competition. If there's a local coffee shop and you open up, somebody opens up a Starbucks next door, it puts the local place out of business. A co-op, God bless you, founded near a kosher butcher, might likely put that butcher out of business. So what do you do? And the response, I'm not going to look it up, but it's very well phrased. It says, fair profits are fine. And in a community where there is a kosher butcher that derives fair profits from the sale of meat, that is fine, and no co-op should be founded. But in a place where business practices on the part of the local kosher butcher are abusive, a Jewish co-op is desirable because it makes kashrut more doable. Okay, smoking, a Jewish perspective. That one was written by Seymour Siegel. And just so you know, in the Orthodox world, the question of smoking, and even smoking on Chag, on holidays, because you can transfer fire, the question of smoking has been brought up many times, and the answer is never no. No Orthodox or ultra-Orthodox rabbi has said no. The closest they have come is, it is forbidden to start smoking, but once you've started, it is permitted to continue. Why? Why? Why is that one of the rationales? Because Judaism, traditional halakha, has always taught that you should only promote laws that people can follow. And if you believe that addiction is insurmountable, to put people in a position that they will be sinning by, without their volition, is unfair. This was a very brave and very difficult tshuva to write. It was actually, just so you know, historically never included in the tshuvot, but Seymour Siegel was one of the leading minds in conservative Jewish law, and it was in testimony to him that it was included in the journal. Okay. Wow, five more to go. We're good. May a non-Kohen, this one's fun, be called first to the Torah in the presence of a Kohen. In our community, we don't presume the question. But there are many communities where if you are in the lineage of being a Kohen, a priest, you get the first Aliyah every time. If you are in the lineage of being a Levi, you get the second Aliyah every time. Levi is the tribe from which Kohanim were derived. Levi was a child of Judah, and the Leviim traditionally served the Kohanim. They came second, but they came before the proletariat. Everybody else. Yisrael, Nebuch, like me. In a system where you have that hierarchy of aliyot, of honors, what if you have a Kohen, only one in your community, but don't have a Levi? Tradition says that Kohen gets the first and second aliyot. And then everybody else is left with one. So in our community, we don't presume that hierarchy of aliyot, but they're trying to figure out whether or not they can do it. You can read it in there. The next one is more radical than any of the others that I've suggested before. A response to miscarriage. Why is it more radical? Because it's written by a woman. Many of these tshuva were not written by women. This tshuva was, and I'm going to quote just a little bit of it, Rabbi Deborah Reed Blank, who's a teacher of mine. She's a professor of liturgy at the seminary. The question is, what should be the Jewish response? What should the Jewish response be to miscarriage? One paragraph from the beginning of her tshuva. The question of what constitutes an appropriate response to miscarriage has been placed on the agenda of the Committee of Jewish Law and Standards, the Supreme Court-ish of Conservative Judaism. The assumption underlying this question is that the tendency to ignore in ritual the emotional impact and physical trauma of miscarriage is probably erroneous. Right? Said in English. Halakha so far ignored what miscarriage does to a person, specifically the mother, the would-have-been mother. And that the presumption that ignoring it is appropriate is wrong. And that a woman is writing this tshuva, a female rabbi is writing this tshuva. The Jewish mindset, dominated by halakha and its formulated responses to virtually every activity and event in one's life, is stymied when confronted by miscarriage, a traumatic event for which there is no formulated response. So we must ask, what should the Jewish response be to miscarriage? Here's one paragraph from within. I'll tell you what her conclusion is in a second. The present lack of a ritual response to miscarriage is a glaring gap, especially for people whose lives are in every other way governed by Jewish law. There must be a formulated response to miscarriage which addresses the emotional impact and the physical trauma, a response which enables the parents to channel and express their emotions, and which enables the community to acknowledge their loss. So if aninut, which is the status of someone who has a loss, but before the funeral happens, and avelut, the Jewish practice of mourning, are not the appropriate responses, what is? And she ends up suggesting that the concept of bikur cholim fits better, because it's not a full life that was lost, but the suffering is incredibly impactful. There is a dissenting opinion written by Rabbi Amy Eilberg. She was the first conservative female rabbi, and she says that's not good enough. Both are recorded as Jewish law. She says, Bikur Cholim, visiting someone who is ill, is not good enough because it's a real loss. And Bikur Cholim pretends it's not. Visiting someone who's ill is not the same as visiting someone who has been touched by death. We can talk about that. I'm just mirroring them. Yes. That all, if not all, most aspects of traditional mourning should be observed. The next one is converts mourning the death of a close relative. This is Rabbi Joel Rembaum, who is a rabbi in L.A. And he talks about historically how conversion to Judaism was seen to be a severing of all linkage to your previous family. And he ends up saying that is both not historically accurate, nor is it healthy. And how does the new Jew, the Jew by choice, express themselves as a Jew in a moment of loss? For whose sake are these rituals? Preparing a body and burying it is one question. Mourning is another. By the way, I'm not sure what the date is, but the our Chevra Kedisha is sponsoring the night where I'm presenting a tshuva that I'm writing on the question of the preparation of the non-Jewish spouse for burial by the Chevra Kedisha. So we'll be talking about that soon. If you have any questions, we can talk about it before that date. I don't know what it is off the top of my head. That's the conference. I'm presenting this sooner. Yes. Yes, the answer of this tshuva is that yes. It is not only a choice, it is an obligation upon the Jew by choice to mourn for their parent in Jewish ways. Okay, just a little bit more. I know that we're doing a lot of stuff, but I want to at least finish up my point. Thank you for being tolerant. I'm not getting up. Mamzerut, the tshuva is about the child of incest or adultery. The tshuva was written by Rabbi Eli Spitz, who recently spoke here in a book called Healing from Despair, which he authored himself. He wrote this tshuva, and it's actually the most important tshuva I've ever read. It changed my life because he suggested that we are willing to do today what we were unwilling to do before. We rely on precedent as a first step, but we are willing to affirm the place of morality as a trump card in Jewish law when all else fails. But what he doesn't do, so Mamzerut says that the child of incest or adultery can never marry a Jew. Can never marry, basically. But what did the child do? So what he says is that we will not uproot the rule from the Torah, but we will never apply it. Conservative rabbis are forbidden to receive testimony as to Mamzerut. So if you know someone, it's halachically a mamzer, and you tell me, I didn't hear a thing and will never act on it. Because to judge a child for their birth circumstance is immoral. In fact, the Torah says that too. We don't judge a child for their parents. One second, I'm on a roll. The concurring opinion regarding mamzerut, which is interestingly included as well, two tshuvot that agree with each other. This one was written by Rabbi Danny Nevins, who is the dean of the rabbinical school at JTS in New York. He's a wonderful scholar and one of the three authors of the tshuva that led to gay inclusion in the conservative movement. He concurs with what Rabbi Eli Spitz wrote in his tshuva on Mamzerut, that we will not accept testimony. But the most powerful thing he does here is he says, I want to explain why it's important to retain the category of Mamzerut. Why dealing with it is better than ripping it out. So he says, this is one paragraph. On an ideological level, the law of Mamzer reminds us that we are not the authors of our tradition, but only the latest generation of its devoted interpreters. Indeed, the Mamzer law has long fulfilled this function, as Rabbi David Hartman has shown in his book, The Living Covenant. There he describes a dialectic of power and powerlessness of our covenanted people vis-a-vis God. Going back to Avraham Avinu, who argued valiantly in defense of the critics of Sodom and Amorah, the towns that were destroyed in the book of Genesis, but was silent on his own son's behalf and extending to rabbinic stories such as David of Achnai that we've discussed before. Our predecessors have alternated postures of vigorous assertion and humble submission before God. The law of the Mamzer, the statute which the rabbis have generation after generation sought to circumscribe without presuming to eliminate altogether. And I would suggest that the reason why not oysters can be summed up in one word. Humility. We are quite powerful, but we are not the authors of our tradition. We are the latest generation of devoted interpreters. And it is much better to retain the stability of the system while changing it where necessary than it is to abdicate its ability as a system to guide us in life. If my disconnect from Kashrut leads me to reject Judaism as a system, I don't have Judaism to turn to anymore. And because of my lack of plugging in, other people will suffer because I wasn't there. So is that an argument for Kashrut? Yeah, actually, it is. The Kashrut is not the goal. As Heschel said, we don't have faith in deeds, we have faith through deeds. And if mitzvah is the way that I remember to show up, then mitzvah is quite important. So I'm going to end with one quote and then I'll stick around for anyone who wants to talk a little bit more. I appreciate your smile. This is by a book called Leave a Little to God by Rabbi Robert Gordas. Here's his face. Very powerful guy. So he writes, "Closer to my heart than the Marseillaise is a third melody, which is entirely enveloped in sorrow. It is a night song of those seeking repentance, broken children of men who regret their sins. This prayer of grief is called Kol Nidrei. I heard it many years ago in my native town. The eve of Yom Kippur had arrived. I hid myself in a corner of the synagogue so that the pious Jews might not be distressed by the presence of a Gentile lad," who's a non-Jewish poet, whose name is Nikolai Lenau, who's writing. "Big, thick wax candles were aflame. The people stood with heads bent low in broad, snow-white garments which looked like shrouds. Suddenly the cantor, with a deeply earnest, heart-rending melody, rich in awe and supplication, began to sing. I had to struggle with a rare feeling of emotion. Feverishly I sighed. Hot, burning tears pouring from one's eyes cast a wondrous spell, and at the same time purified. I fled into the night and came home. In that unforgettable hour, no black speck defiled my soul. Who had created this melody? The old people do not know. They have received this song from inheritance from their ancestors. Such grief-stricken songs, it seems to me, are never created by individuals. Yet it is a mysterious melody which undoubtedly has surged up from hundreds of souls. Yom Kippur is likely the hardest day to show up. And yet more people show up that night and day than any other day. Why do we choose the hardest one to all show up on?" The response to the question might be, how could we not? It carries so much that we show up. It burdens us so much that we show up. Even those who in no other way are ritually, quote, obedient to Jewish tradition, show up. Because it is, I would suggest, the authentic way to be a Jew on Yom Kippur. To have your heart broken. I think that's what tradition's about. I think there are sometimes we feel it more than others. But to the question, why not oysters? I think the response is, why would I? Why should we? Who says that's important? It might taste good. I mean, I'm not a poet, no, and then we'll talk. But why would I? What's so urgent about it? Is that the same as finding a way to include the non-Jewish members of my family in my shul? It's not the same. Is it the same as making sure that leadership is shared between men and women? Is it the same as trying to figure out what Judaism says about capital punishment? So there's a place for those conversations. But again, like Rabbi Roth says, just because there's an answer that's halakhically acceptable, must it be halakhically desirable? And I would suggest that the answer is sometimes no. And that the answer no is the same painful required statement of a Jew as Kol Nidrei, ultimately. So we'll talk some more. Thanks for coming, guys.
Oh.